Hi, y'all. This is Kristen Chenoweth.
Hi, I'm Gloria Stefan.
This is Sarah Bareilles.
Hi, I'm Patti LuPone.
This is Lin-Manuel Miranda. You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
Hello, everybody out there in the podcasting iTunes, SoundCloud, Stratosphere airwaves. Welcome to Broadway Breakdown. As promised, I am your host, Matt Koplik, and as promised, John Miscavige is currently lying on a hospital bed, living his best organ life. No, it's not sad. I was just telling our guest today that he's posting on social media, so clearly he's not in that much pain. We love you, John. Joining us today for a very special episode of My Obsession is Broadway musical director-conductor Patrick Sulkin.
Hello.
Hello, Patrick.
Hi, Matt.
That's Sulkin, not Skulkin. I do love that your last name is Sulkin. They're like, do people say, Patrick, quit Sulkin?
Oh, absolutely. That is the number one thing from old people. From anyone under the age of 30, it usually has to do with Patrick Starr, strangely.
Like the from SpongeBob?
The character from SpongeBob.
But you're so not him. Is that the joke?
I don't know. I think they hear Patrick S and their brains stop working.
Mm, that would make sense.
So
I do like that I made the Sulkin reference and then you're like, yes, old people.
Well, you know.
Yeah, I'm
old. Old people, like erudite gays like us.
I live my best life drinking martinis with a bunch of old women. Patrick was the conductor and music director, associate music director for Kinky Boots, or because you guys have titles that I'm not sure what the differences are.
Yes, truly. So at Kinky Boots, I actually never had a full-time position.
Well, that's gross. I subbed
a lot. So I was there for weeks at a time, usually subbing for the associate music director. But until that person leaves for sure, or leaves mm-hmm. for good, you know, I was a nebulous kind of in the building face without a name.
I find that very homophobic. but you made your conducting debut with Kinky Boots, correct?
I did. I conducted yes. Kinky Boots a couple times. Have subbed on some other shows,
such as
the ill-fated revival of Gigi.
Gigi! I was at opening fucking night of Gigi.
As was I.
Were you?
I was.
Oh my god, that show. What others were there?
Gigi, I was a music assistant on Something Rotten.
Awesome.
And did some playing of rehearsals for that company. I was at Kinky Boots playing rehearsals and subbing for about 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
I subbed at Anastasia.
Anastasia,
yes. And then took
Journey to the Past.
Journey to the Past. Took up my current position at Pretty Woman. I actually started working with them from the first reading.
Mm. So beginning to end with you.
Beginning to end.
Yeah.
End is a very fresh wound.
So we won't dig too deep into it then. We'll be like, so how does it feel now that it's over?
Now that you don't have a job anymore, how does it feel?
Don't feel too bad for him. He's got jobs lined up. How does one become a music director? What, like, drew you to that line of work?
Well, I started playing the piano at 5.
Mm.
And growing up, essentially wanted to be some sort of classical musician, music teacher, Mr. Holland type.
Sorry.
You know, sleeping with my students.
No, he never slept with them. He just fantasized
just,
about
truly,
it.
Just fell in love with her.
How do you not fall in love with her, though? She's the one good singer in that Gershwin review. We're talking about Mr. Holland's Opus, by the way, a lovely Richard Dreyfuss movie from the 90s. So Patrick saw Mr. Holland's Opus and got all the wrong motivations from it.
Yes.
Wanted that life.
Yes, so wanted to be a high school choir director, became obsessed with musical theater along the way, and in college kind of blended those two worlds, was still a music education major, but ended up conducting and playing piano for and music directing a lot of the shows in school. That became my path of choice. I tried to do the thing where I would audition for a show one quarter and then music direct a show the next quarter, and that kind of fell off after sophomore year. I got bored of not being the best actor. So I like chose the music directing
very
path.
Fair.
Yeah.
I mean, that affects a lot of us where you're like, if I'm not going to be the best at it, why do I even do it?
My mother calls me out on that all the time. I've done it since I was 4 years old. Like, I would play baseball and get to the level where I was like no longer the best catcher and quit, or like ran cross country.
And look at you now.
And look at me now. The best catcher of them all.
Oh, hi, Josh.
Can we keep that? We can edit that out. Yeah, we'll keep it.
I fully intend to keep
okay,
that.
Great.
Yeah, maybe listen to another episode of this, Patrick, with me and John, because if we don't mention bottoming once, it's not an episode of Broadway Breakdown.
Okay, great.
Billy, I beg to differ with you.
How do you mean?
You're the top.
Yeah.
You're an arrow collar. You're the top. You're a Coolidge dollar.
So, let's pretend that I'm very stupid.
Great.
Explain to me, and through me, some of our listeners, what exactly a music director does.
So, let me use Pretty Woman as an example.
Great.
Because a music director's job kind of changes as the process gets bigger and more complex. So at the very first reading of Pretty Woman, I actually work with pop rock songwriters mm-hmm. a bunch. So I'll just come at it from my very narrow lens. And, mm-hmm. You know, you can ask any questions that you have. But Bryan Adams and Jim Vallance, who wrote the score to Pretty Woman, I do not believe write music. They don't notate music. Mm. So the music director's job kind of starts transcribing the songs from the demos that they write, you know, writing them down into notes and words and music, and making it playable by a single pianist to create the very first piano vocal score. that goes on the stands for the first reading, and the music director's job is to teach the music to the actors and also work with the composers to shape it, mm-hmm. You know, building dance breaks and vocal harmonies and
building the songs to
building the songs into a piece of musical theater that mm-hmm. flows and has an arc. And then as the show grows through readings and workshops, you also collaborate with the director, mm-hmm. Shaping incidental music, more dance breaks. And as the show develops, you're bringing more people onto the music team. Mm-hmm. A typical tree, I guess, of a music team is the music supervisor at the top, who really is just the wrangler of all the people that fall beneath him.
Usually, they play God.
Yes, absolutely. Music supervisor often doubles as the orchestrator, not always. The orchestrator takes the piano vocal and writes it for all of the instruments in the pit. Mm-hmm. Sometimes there's a dance arranger who will work directly with the choreographer. There are a couple people in the city that really are known for their dance arrangings, David Chase and Sam Davis and David Dabin. Sometimes there's a separate vocal arranger like Anne-Marie Malazzo. And then just the conducting staff. There is the conductor who waves his or her arms every night. Usually they have an associate who will play keyboard 2
yes.
and sub in conducting whenever they're not there. Sometimes there's a keyboard 3 assistant, so a third person in line. And often at the bottom of the chain, quote unquote, is the music assistant who does all of the logistical work, keeping up the notation files and keeping everybody in order. That's usually a fresh out of college.
Yeah, that's things that you had done.
Absolutely.
It's very, very, very sensible. Moving on. We'll trim some of this out just to get what your obsession is. Because the point of this episode, Patrick, is that you're obsessed with something.
I am obsessed with a lot of things. Mm-hmm. But most specifically, for the purposes of this podcast, the musical Seussical.
Thank you, Jesus.
Written by Lynn Ahrens and Stephen Flaherty, two of Broadway's greatest. I would say the king and queen.
Yeah, I mean, if not the king and queen, at least prince and princess. But yeah, I would probably say king and queen. They are the modern day Compton and Green, except they also write music.
Absolutely.
Whereas Compton and Green were just lyrics.
Just lyrics.
Well, and books. And books sometimes, yeah. Which, Lynn Ahrens only did the book for Once on This Island, right? I don't think she ever did a book after that.
You know, I cannot speak intelligently on that.
Unless, I guess,
I think they are credited book and lyrics because it's sung through.
Yeah.
Conception is credited to Eric Idle.
Okay, so we have him. Thank you, Eric Idle.
Yes.
How did you come to get to know Seussical the Musical?
So, I have a very Peggy Sawyer past in that I am from the middle of nowhere in Ohio.
Okay.
With big Broadway dreams. So my access to musical theater came through literally the public library and their CD collection.
Who fell down for you to get your shot? That's the Peggy Sawyer story that no one talks about.
That we can cut out of the episode.
There's a reason why Eric Stern's no longer on Broadway. Patrick Sulkin pushed him down a flight of fucking stairs.
Absolutely.
I'm keeping that shit.
Yeah.
So, okay. Public library was how you got your musical theater Broadway dreams in your little gay brain.
In my little gay brain. And my mother, who had two musical theater obsessions, The Phantom of the Opera and A Chorus Line, two CDs that were in the car, I believe, from the day I was born until I graduated high school.
Mm-hmm.
I can sing them note perfect, word perfect, because my mom never stops listening to them. That initially turned me on. And then I just periodically went through my library CD collection, found Seussical, absolutely fell in love with it.
Oh, yeah.
Later wrote Lynn and Steve a fan letter.
Ooh.
When I was in fifth grade, half telling them how much I loved Seussical, half asking them to play JoJo on the national tour.
that's how everyone books national tours, just writing to them, please cast me.
Yeah, you write the composers. They actually sent about 6 months later, because I sent it to their old agent at like WME and who forwarded it to their new agent at Gersh, which she explained to me in the letter and my fifth grade brain did not understand and now is wild to me. They were so kind, saying like, I don't know if you know our other work, but you might want to look into Ragtime or Once on This Island or My Favorite Year or the film Anastasia. The best part about being
I love that did they actually throw in My Favorite Year, or did you just throw that in?
I just threw that
in. Okay, so, I'll say that, like, that's them taking advantage of an 11-year-old by saying, like, you want to check out My Favorite Year? I swear it's good.
Yes,
it's not good.
Has my heart though.
Does it?
It really does.
Is it just because of Larger Than Life? Is that why?
Yeah.
That's a good song.
Mm-hmm. The album really has my heart.
Okay. Yeah. Listen, we all have our things. Everyone on this podcast, Lord knows they know how much I love Smile, but like, we all have our things.
We all have our things.
We all have our things.
And my junk is Seussical. Seussical was only on Broadway for 4 months, I believe.
Something like that. It wasn't quite like a one-week bomb, but I think it was maybe 4 or 5 months.
Yeah, so something around just shy of 200 performances, I believe.
Yeah, it was definitely under that.
So a fall opening and a
late spring closing, I believe.
Yes.
They closed around the Tony Awards.
Mm-hmm.
Because they brought in... This is how we're going to get even further into this, because you brought this up earlier. They brought in Rosie O'Donnell to spike ticket sales.
Yes.
And I guess she did, because they lasted.
Yeah.
When I saw it, she had left. I saw Kathy Rigby, who was delightful. And the rest of the original company, plus Aaron Carter. So it was... If there was one way to see Seussical, it was the way I saw it.
Absolutely.
To get Aaron Carter, but also to get Jean LaManna and Michelle Phoch.
Ugh.
Michelle Phoch on that album.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
And funny, there are some archives available on the internet,
mm-hmm.
if you were. And if you're to watch that, Michelle Phoch is giving such an incredible performance,
mm-hmm.
And that you could tell kind of had life and breath in it. You know, mm-hmm. I could tell that the archive that I saw was very different from the performance that had happened before and was going to happen the next night.
Mm-hmm.
Which is not to say that everyone else wasn't doing phenomenal work, because they were. Kevin Chamberlain giving the most soulful, simple, beautiful performance.
That, dropped in, grounded, yeah.
That you can really hear on the album. That's why I think it's such a magical thing that really brought me into the world of the show and of Aaron's and Flaherty in general. I think they did a really good job of translating the performances to the album.
Mm.
You know, Sharon Wilkins, like, big, beautiful, like, earth mama voice.
Oh, yeah, just shaking you to your core.
Absolutely.
One of the things I've always been obsessed with, and I didn't know who she was for the longest time, and then when I saw Avenue Q and I made the connection that this was her, Anne Harada as the bailiff.
As the bailiff.
Her solo, "This is the case of the people versus Horn the Elephant." Her voice on that is so good. Judge Yoda the turtle reside in everyone. Rise. That might have been the moment that I turned gay.
This is the case of the people versus Horn the Elephant.
Horn the Elephant.
Judge Yoda the turtle presiding, everyone. Rise.
Later in life, I've discovered that the ensemble of Seussical was just, like, filled with stars.
Oh, yeah.
And
Casey Nicholaw was in the ensemble.
Casey Nicholaw. I believe it was his last Broadway show as a performer. Or Millie. Was, yeah. Right after.
He went out on a high note. He's like, this cannot be my last performance.
Correct. These 4 months can't define me.
No.
In a shaggy purple faux elephant thing at the Circus McGurkus.
Oh my God. Yeah, those costumes were interesting.
Insane. So, yeah. Ensemble stacked. Yeah. Design team also stacked.
Yeah.
But big drama.
Oh yeah.
Out of town tryout in Boston.
Disaster.
Complete
disaster.
Frank Galati, director.
Mm-hmm.
Catherine Zuber, costumes. Natasha Katz, lights.
Eugene Lee sets.
Almost everyone replaced for Broadway.
Mm-hmm.
Frank Galati, uncredited. Rob Ashford was Rob Marshall.
Yes, Rob
was
Marshall
brought on as an uncredited director. His sister Kathleen had always been the choreographer. Her best friend and roommate Rob Ashford was the associate choreographer. William Ivy Long was brought on to do the costumes. I believe someone was brought on uncredited to fix quote unquote the set.
Yeah, I think they mostly just simplified, because the Broadway set actually isn't all that impressive. It's a lot of open space.
Yes, truly.
Yeah. It's also the first time they presented Seussical, and the reason why it had the backing it had was because they did a workshop production, like in a black box theater with a cast of 10, and Andrea Martin was the Cat in the Hat, mm-hmm. and all they had was like a ladder and some like handmade props. And everybody's like, this is brilliant. This is amazing. Let's throw $15 million at it.
Yes.
And that's where the problem started.
Yeah. And actually some superstar producers, Fran and Barry Weisler, mm-hmm. now of Chicago and Waitress, Hal Luftig as an associate producer, now lead producer of Kinky Boots and Becoming Nancy. And
speaking of Jerry Mitchell.
So that initial reading was in Toronto, kind of produced with Livent. Convict Garth Drabinsky was in charge, who Aaron's and Flaherty had a long relationship with Ragtime,
yes.
obviously.
Yes.
Yeah, and there was such buzz around that little production. Mm-hmm. And I believe it was mostly the same cast other than Andrea Martin.
That I think that's true, yes.
Yeah, replaced by David Shiner.
Yes.
Famous clown.
Mm-hmm.
Truly clown.
True clown.
Not derogatory.
With Bill Irwin. Yeah. Bill Irwin, Tony-winning actor, became famous for his clowning with David Shiner. They were a duo act.
Yeah.
They had a play called Full Moon, I believe. And yeah, they exploded from there, but Bill Irwin became more of a real actor. I don't want to talk down to their clowning.
Oh no, no,
no. Talents, but Bill Irwin transitioned into stage acting and text based acting.
Yes,
a little more easily. That's the right word.
More easily.
That doesn't sound like it should be the
but
right
I think
one.
It is right.
Yeah. It doesn't sound right. More easily than Shiner did.
Yes.
But Shiner was the original Cat in the Hat on the Broadway. Not for long. He got replaced pretty quickly by Rosie.
Yeah, so I believe he was in it for a couple months, mm-hmm. and then to boost ticket sales, they brought in Rosie, who, for all intents and purposes, had to reinvent the role because mm-hmm. his act was so clowny and so transformative and so physical. Mm-hmm. Rosie's obviously a very verbal comedian.
Yes.
And such a personality that obviously keys had to be changed for Rosie. She kind of did a yuck yuck performance, like really interacting with the audience. And I don't know if that was the Broadway performance of David as well and how much audience interaction, but there was a lot of like making fun of the person in the front row mm-hmm. and making a Les Mis reference and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And you saw Kathy Rigby in the role.
I did.
How did that transform from Rosie to Kathy?
Well, so I told you before we were recording, I did happen to come upon a bootleg of Rosie and watched a little bit of it because I've always been fascinated by that. Rosie definitely had like a very dry New Yorker attitude in the role, which like was fun, but she definitely was not physical, like mostly just kind of sat and stood.
Correct.
Yes, did not dance, did not do anything, you know, play to your strengths. Kathy Rigby was very physical. I remember the opening, so Oh the Things You Can Think, one of my favorite opening numbers of all time, and I'm not being like a little shit about it, it's very true.
Absolutely, they can write an opening number, those two.
Oh yes, their opening numbers are great. Well, my favorite year again. I've done a lot of numbers from that show for like other classes and whatnot, and I'm always just sort of like, it's not as good as I want it to be.
It's very early work of theirs.
Oh yeah, I mean it was like, because it's a lot of it's supposed to be very funny, and it's not. I don't find it very funny. There's literally a song called "Funny,"
yes,
and I find it the opposite of that.
Oh.
Accordion lessons, bah. Speaking of Andrew Martin. Anywho, the opening set piece was like a giant vortex, like a colorful vortex was the opening image.
Yes, with like an eye hole in the middle.
Which Kathy Rigby popped out of. And then when she said, no, there's no telling what, but I'll give you a clue, she tumbled out of it. So like Rosie slid, and I don't know what David Shiner did, but like Kathy Rigby full on did like a gymnastic tumble.
Wow.
And then like flipped onto the stage.
Yes.
Yes, a lot of that.
That's everything.
Oh, yeah. She was very physical. She was surprisingly, like, versatile in her personas and whatnot. I remember her as the German doctor was very funny. And then there's a plot line. For those of you that don't know Seussical, it's about...
I bet we could do it together.
Okay. It's sort of like a kid version of Grand Hotel when you think about it. Lots of plot lines all intersecting.
Oh, that's true.
And it's quite dark at times.
Yes, there are two main plot lines. One, Horton the Elephant of Horton Hears a Who fame.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not going to do that for the rest of the characters. that would be...
of this book fame. Of
yes,
this story
that game. Would be sure. Much too much.
Yeah, we'll start with that, though.
Is chilling in the jungle of Newell.
Mm-hmm. In the heat of the day, the cool of the pool.
He was splashing, splash, enjoying the jungle's Greg Joyce.
Sarah Gettelfinger.
Yes.
And Natasha Diaz, Bird Ladies.
Oh my gosh, yes.
There's actually, so we'll continue the plot in a second. I haven't watched the official video at Lincoln Center Library, but apparently the day that they were filming it, one of them, I think it's Natasha Diaz, because you're told when it's going to be filmed,
yes,
and everyone gets a little bonus in their paycheck that week because it's part of equity stipulations. Natasha Diaz apparently for an exit decided to do like a very dramatic flourish that she had never done before, and apparently like face planted because of it, and it's on there forever.
Oh no,
that I haven't seen it yet, but that is what I've been told. Is that like she tried to do something with her hand as she was going off stage to like make a lasting impression and just. Bombed at it.
And that's what you do. That's what you get for ad-libbing.
Yeah, that's... You gotta stick to the staging and the script, especially when it's being preserved.
Yes.
There's a reason why it's being preserved.
Do your show.
Yeah. Anyway, so yes, Horton splashing splash.
Splashing splash. Hears a noise mm-hmm. from a speck of dust. Puts it on a clover.
Mm-hmm.
The speck of dust is the tiny planet of Who.
Mm-hmm. Of which the young boy and thinker Jojo... lives on. He is the son of the mayor and his wife, and Jojo is constantly getting into trouble for having too many thinks. He thinks too much.
Yes. So, tragically, his parents send him to military school.
Mm-hmm. Scared straight.
Which is so intense.
It is. And on top of that, Horton is ridiculed by everyone in his jungle for claiming that a speck of dust can talk, because everyone says, well, we can't hear it, we can't see it, so therefore it must not exist.
Yeah. So truly, the next plot point, really, happens in the middle of Act 2, when you see Jojo at war, and we think that Jojo has died.
Mm-hmm.
His parents are sad. Guess what? Jojo didn't actually die.
No.
And Horton is put on trial by his peers for
disrupting the peace.
Disrupting the peace.
And loitering on an egg. Because, well, so then, well, now we got to go back to Act 1, because there are two other plot points that we haven't discussed.
But I feel like they're ancillary.
What?
Ancillary.
What? Because they're women, Patrick?
No. Oh, I've forgotten all about Gertrude and Maisie.
That's what I'm talking about, bitch.
Go ahead.
God, throwing them women's under the buses. There is a character named Gertrude McFuzz, who is played by Janine LaManna, who gave one of the most underrated performances in a musical, up there with Sally Murphy and Carousel, like top five most underrated for me in all of musical
Absolutely.
Theater. She greatly cares for Horton. She's the only one who believes him, but she thinks that Horton doesn't pay attention to her because she just has one tiny little feather of a tail.
Yeah, a teeny little feather.
So she goes to a doctor by the urgings of Michelle Pock's Maisie LaBird, who is a beautiful, selfish bird with the grandest of tails. She goes to a doctor to take some pills, gets a giant tail. But then when Horton gets kidnapped by hunters, she can't save him because her tail is too heavy. And Horton gets kidnapped by hunters because he agrees to help Maisie LaBird out and sit on her egg for her for a while because she is too selfish and wants too much fun to sit on an egg for all that time it takes to hatch an egg.
Yes. And now we have to take the detour where that I believe the show should not have taken, which is the Circus McGurkus, which is a 12-minute sequence at the top of Act 2,
mm-hmm.
Where we see all of the circus animals and Horton is essentially the
star attraction.
Yeah, the Violet and Daisy of Sideshow.
Same theater, too.
The Rogers.
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness.
Thank you for knowing it was the Rogers.
Oh, of course.
Oh, my God. I feel so seen today. If John were opposite of me, he would just be like, of course you know that, and roll his eyes, and we'd move on.
Yes, sure. Thanks, John. We love you.
We love you, John. Get better.
So he's put on trial from the circus. In later iterations, in the National Tour version, and what is now licensed by MTI, the Circus McGurkus is Gagon.
Yes. There are like four versions of Seussical that MTI licenses, I do believe.
Yeah, I believe it's like Kids Junior.
Yeah, there's the Kids Junior, there's the one-act version, there's the Theater for Young Audiences version, and then I think there's a full two-act version.
Yes.
But even in the two-act version, Circus McGurkus is gone.
Is gone.
The War with Butterside Up, is that also cut, or is that still there?
I am not quite sure. Mm. There's a framing device in the two-act version that's licensed.
Yes, where Jojo opens the show now.
Yes, Jojo is an unnamed boy until the Cat in the Hat throws him into the story.
I'm not here for that six characters in search of an author bullshit in my Seussical.
Honestly, like, every show that I saw in college had a framing device. It was a very intellectual, director-driven thing. I don't need my Seussical to have it.
No. Why must everything have a framing device, Patrick?
Hashtag not my Seussical.
No. You know, I think that's what was missing from Gigi was a framing device.
It would have run.
Yeah,
more
it
would
have run. Because I think Eric Schaefer, no shade thrown, but I think Eric Schaefer heard the term framing device and used it literally and was like, well, the Eiffel Tower will frame the stage. And like, that's not what we mean by a framing device.
But Eric Schaefer. Dave McLean set was gorge.
It was a very pretty set.
Yeah.
And then I also remember Scarlett Strallen, was that her name? The one who played the slutty girl?
Stephanie Lee.
Stephanie Lee. I get those two confused all the damn time. Stephanie Lee played the slutty girl that Corey Cott liked.
Yes, Leanne.
Leanne. It's played by Zsa Zsa Gabor in the movie.
Oh, wow.
Have you ever seen the movie Gigi?
I haven't. I'm bad.
I'm
bad at not seeing movies that my shows are based on.
Yeah, or any movies.
Well, truly, we could play a game that you can cut out, but any movie that you think me as a 28-year-old gay man should have seen, I'm going to have seen none of them.
Okay. Well, there's also, there's my opinion of what gay men should see, and then there's, like, what everyone else thinks.
Yes.
Like, I've made it very open that I think Little Mermaid is the most LGBTQ Disney movie of all time, and everyone comes to me about it, and I'm like, no, you're wrong. And
then Ursula is divine.
She is divine, yeah, but yeah. The whole movie's about how a parent understands that their child's road to happiness is different from their own.
Honestly, yeah. If you really think about it, that's a deep dive.
Not really, because the last scene of the movie is all about King Triton finally accepting Ariel. The last spoken line of the movie is Ariel to her father after she gets married saying, I love you, Daddy.
Wow.
Yeah. You should watch it again.
I should watch it again.
It also, it's the beginning of the Disney Renaissance formula of the outsider. Here's our society. Here's our outsider who doesn't fit in. And then, like, finding a compromise between society and our outsider by the end of it.
Yes. Oh.
Belle in the provincial town.
Yes.
Simba, like, shying away from responsibility. Aladdin being a street rat. Blah, 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 blah.
Yes, truly.
Mulan's like, I'm not a bride.
Pocahontas
is like, I don't know what river to take. You know what I'm talking about.
Yeah. Hercules is an orphan. And also a demigod.
He wants to go to the distance. Yeah. Mulan wants to find her reflection. Mm-hmm. Pocahontas wants to go around the river bend. Aladdin wants to stay one jump ahead of the bread line. And Belle just thinks that there must be more than this provincial life.
Yes.
And Ariel wants to be where the people are.
I truly, all the I Want songs, and bringing it back to Seussical, I don't believe that Seussical has a proper...
How dare you come back to the topic
at hand? How dare I? I don't believe it has a proper I Want song.
No, it doesn't. Because Well, I guess you could say Alone in the Universe is like an unconditional I Want song.
Yeah.
Because it's not about what... It's not about so much what either character wants, because they don't know what it is that they want. It's just about what the world is denying them. And then at the end, they realize that they need each other, because all they needed was someone to listen to them.
Yeah, yeah. We kind of intuit. They actually don't state what they want.
No.
Nobody knows that I have wings, I can fly.
Mm-hmm.
So they're craving that person who does.
Mm-hmm.
But the, you know... Unlike a traditional musical, they get that at the end of the song in each other.
And it's halfway through Act 1, actually, maybe even three quarters into Act 1, that song happens. It's flipping the formula on its head.
Yeah.
Seussical breaking boundaries.
Re-listening to Seussical, I realize that it is like the hero's journey. It's Odysseus, it's the Wizard of Oz, which like kind of is dramatically inert in and of itself. It is a person that like does a bunch of things and faces a lot of challenges, and it like a video game level, they just overcome the challenge and then another challenge, which is why sometimes when you listen to Seussical or read the libretto in a traditional musical where you would cut a song that doesn't directly impact the plot, there are a lot of songs that you would cut.
Absolutely.
Like the Marsha Milgram Dodge reworking that I think is now the one act version.
Yes.
Which went on a national tour is like 85 minutes long. And I have not seen it, but it is, I'm sure, just like streamlined. It's, you got Horton, you got JoJo, you got Gertrude.
There's nobody else.
Yeah, nobody else.
Would that mean she cut Amazing Maisie?
I hope not.
That song is like top five for me. I also weirdly love Maisie and Palm Peach. It's just such a great diversion. And it comes back to Horton being in the circus. The circus, I love his show.
I think I'll go.
Back in my YouTube web series days when I was doing Bacon It, Alex Boniello came on and I found out that Michelle Pach was one of his teachers. And he turns to the camera and goes, yes, Tony Winner, Michelle Pach. And I went... Maisie LaBird, Michelle Pach. How dare you?
How dare you invoke the Tony?
And she also plays the Nazi prostitute in Cabaret, which I just said like I was British.
Cabaret.
That with Natasha
Fräulein Kost.
Yeah.
Oh.
Look at you knowing the name. In the Natasha Richardson cast album, she's the one who goes, "Herr Ludwig, you're not going on so early." Yeah, and also she doubles as one of the Kit Kat girls. Fritzi. The one where she's the slutty one.
Which
one. Well, you knew Cost.
Well, they're all slutty.
The one who, like, squats down and he's like, stop doing that. We lost three waiters and a bottle of champagne up there.
Ah, yes.
Yes.
That one.
Yes, because she's so loose, people. Uh-huh. That's implication.
A vagina joke.
Yes, it's a giant vagina joke. Literally.
Seussical. I'm ruminating on Michelle Pach's career to have been branded just like the kind of loose woman in so many shows.
Yeah. Hello Again. She even was Donna for a while in Mamma Mia. Talk about loose women.
Whoa.
Very short time. Apparently, The Gift was starting to lose her by the time she did Mamma Mia, and she was gone pretty soon.
Oh, which interesting.
Is a shame, because mm-hmm. in her heyday, she could have torn that role to pieces.
Well, yes. And Michelle, I don't believe, is a dancer. No. Having seen videos of Seussical, Janine is a dancer.
Yeah.
Was Nikki in the Sweet Charity revival,
mm-hmm.
Replaced Lois Lane...
Lois Lane.
In the Kiss Me Kate revival in the 99. So I don't know if that was before...
Kiss Me Kate was before Seussical, but Sweet Charity was after Seussical. I can tell you that with full authority.
Not the Christina Applegate.
No, she's in the Christina Applegate Sweet Charity.
Oh, really?
So she replaced, bringing back to Seussical, she replaced Natasha Diaz in that Christina Applegate Sweet Charity.
Oh.
Because that tea there was... So they went out of town. I'm assuming people who listen to this pod know that story, which is they were in Milwaukee first, and Christina Applegate broke her ankle, or broke her foot, and they had to go to Boston next, and they weren't sure if they were going to bring it to Broadway or not. There was a time where Charlotte Demoise came in, like, last minute to replace Christina Applegate for Boston. They then said, we're going to bring it to Broadway. Then they said no. Then Christina Applegate's like, no, I'll just do it with a boot. So they brought it to Broadway anyway. But Natasha Diaz was Nikki in Milwaukee and in Boston, but she and the girl who was playing Helene kept stealing the show, and so they got replaced. And Janine LaMana and somebody else. It's Janine LaMana, right? Not Janine DeVita?
LaMana.
LaMana, yeah.
Yeah.
Because there's a Janine DeVita in the Broadway world as well, and I always get them...
Because
how many women are named Janine?
Yes.
Them and Janine DeSori, but yes. She spells it differently.
Yes.
Thank you for laughing. This is why I'm happy to have you here.
Oh, yes.
Literally, all this shit that I'm saying today, John would just be like, stop it.
Stop.
He's like, don't you ever turn it off?
Yeah. No is the answer.
No is the answer. But yeah, no, they replaced them because they were stealing the show. And then when they brought it to Broadway, Christina Applegate couldn't dance. So something better than this became Janine LaMana and whoever played Helene dancing instead of Christina Applegate. She like sat there and watched.
Dancing around her?
Yeah. Stupid.
Bizarre.
And then Charlotte Demoise would come on sometimes because she was the standby for Broadway, and she was like, can I just do it with him?
Yes,
like,
please, can I dance?
Can I just dance, please? But yeah, no, Janine LaMana, dancer. And I think even had a couple of kicks in there in Seussical.
Yes, I believe so.
Yeah, because Gertrude didn't have like any dance numbers.
No, it's mostly her alone on stage.
Yes, but her outfit, though, was a dancer outfit. She wore a tiny blue dress that barely covered her vagina.
Yes.
For a kid's show, there were some sexual costumes.
Yes. Like, the Wickersham brothers are, like, go-go boys?
And, yeah, and shredded. Like, talk about, you know, gay epiphanies.
Right. Absolutely.
Like, watching that show. The Rogers had some gay-ass shows in there. It had Sideshow with those belting ladies, mm-hmm. followed by Footloose with a bunch of 90s butt boys. And then it had Seussical with the Wickersham brothers. Like, it's just, it's gay.
Yes. And, well, D-Hody is the star of Footloose.
D-Hody. First of all, Jennifer Laura Thompson is the star of Footloose.
No, you're mistaken.
How?
D-Hody is the star of
D-Hody
everything
is
that she's
D-Hody is the Tony
in.
Nominee of Footloose. I know that. I'm aware of that. But Jennifer Laura Thompson is the star of Footloose, in my opinion.
Yeah,
my mind got blown when I was like, I'm sorry, she was Ariel in Footloose and Julie Jordan in Carousel? Like, literally back-to-back? She was Julie Jordan on the national tour of Carousel.
Wow.
So, all the things that I know about that production of Carousel will blow your mind.
The Nick Heitner?
Yes. The good one. Not the one that just played.
Opinions.
That is not scandalous.
No,
Everyone knows that production was shit. I'm thrilled that Lindsay Mendez is a Tony winner. I wish it was for something else.
But the Heitner is truly like a top two. It's Stroklahoma and the Heitner Carousel are the only two revivals that matter in my brain ever.
I mean, those are very true. Well, no one's going to do Carousel as well as that Heitner one, and everyone knows it. So, like, it's why we all kind of just go, don't revive it again. You're not going to do any better.
Mm-hmm.
But Lauren Ward of Violet and Matilda fame was the understudy Julie Jordan on Broadway.
Oh.
She's one of the tap dancing bearded ladies in the opening. And I found that out because I ran into her at a restaurant once with my dad while Matilda was on Broadway. And it was we were both closing the restaurant and I got very drunk and I sat down. And I was like, I know you're in Carousel.
Oh my God.
And she's like, I was a bearded lady. And I was like, tell me more. We just talked, and Linda Eman was there. We just talked about Carousel for 10 minutes. And she's like, well, you know that Sally Murphy's Linda Eman's neighbor, right? I was like, I didn't. Tell me more.
tell me all about it.
Tell me all about it, stud. And the national tour, Sarah You're Right Barry was, or You're Righty? Sarah You're Right Barry is how you say her name, right? Yeah, she was Julie Jordan on the tour opposite Patrick Wilson. And then Jennifer Laura Thompson was in the ensemble and replaced Sarah You're Right Barry on the tour as Julie Jordan.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. Some big-ass divas have played that role.
Yes.
Yeah. But Jennifer Laura Thompson, in my mind, is the star of Footloose. But you can have Dee Hody. I'll let you have her.
Okay, yes. Yes. Just to speak about, like, very gay things.
Oh, and Catherine Cox of Baby fame.
Oh,
yeah.
Don't even get me started on Baby, but...
We can talk
there's
about
not,
Baby.
There's not time.
There's not time in the world for Baby.
Yes.
Why hasn't Encores done Baby yet?
I don't know.
They're it's doing perfect. Fucking Millie, but they won't do Baby.
Right.
That's why Jack Fertel's leaving. Yes. Everyone on the board was like, no, this is bullshit.
There was that Paper Mill production of Baby that like had some traction, and I think became inert for some reason, you know, in the way that all shows become inert.
Absolutely. So, I mean, it was also back in the day when Paper Mill like wasn't really transferring shows yet, so no one took it seriously. Did you just do some yoga in front of me?
I just did like a big old stretch, you know?
It was great. Just talking about Baby and stretching your wings and your arms. Speaking of wings, you know who has wings? JoJo. He can fly.
great segue.
Listen, you've been bringing us back on topic so much, I need to do the same
you
thing.
You need to do it. Yes, you're correct.
So, Horton gets put on trial for sitting on an egg, disturbing the peace.
Wow, we took a huge tangent.
Oh my God, yeah. And I'm not cutting a goddamn minute of it.
Great.
It's all fucking gold.
It's gold.
And Gertrude comes to like his defense, and they decide in the court that the speck of dust that Horton's been protecting as well, they're going to boil it in oil, which I think is a little extreme considering it's a speck of dust.
Right, and he gets sent to an insane, or they sentence him to an insane asylum.
Yes, they do. But before any of that happens, finally JoJo of Whoville, the Who's finally like, JoJo, think of something. We need to be heard because the Who's can't get themselves heard. And finally, little thinker gay JoJo shouts, yop, which I think he meant to shout top. He was shouting for a top.
Then he'd be heard.
Because he put the Who in Whoer. Is what I'm saying about
Miss JoJo.
Let me tell you about Miss JoJo. Oh, that's a good drag name, Miss JoJo.
Miss JoJo. Ooh.
Miss JoJo. Yes. Searching for a yop.
Yep. Oh my God. What a niche thing that, like, I would absolutely attend that drag show and no one else.
Patrick, I think.
You and Mike Bello would come too.
Yeah. Mike Bello and I have a fake drag act that we don't actually do, but. I have two drag names and Mike has one, and his would be Izzy Rich and I would be Jesse Is. Yeah.
Right.
And we would just sing Bosom Buddies over and over and over again. And then my other one, my solo show is Tearaway Pants.
Tearaway Pants?
Yeah.
Great.
Thank you.
Love it.
It takes people a minute sometimes. But maybe I'll do another one as Miss JoJo and I'll curate it with you.
Yes.
Yes.
We will do all of Susan, like a two queen susicle.
A two queen susicle, but we have to do it with like, I don't know, intercut with like random all you know what? This is how we're going to get you to watch Drop Dead Gorgeous. We're going to intercut it with all this dialogue from Drop Dead Gorgeous.
Oh.
So it's going to be, talking to a speck of dust, cut with Allison Janney. Do you think a nice cool mint would help if I shoved your head up your ass?
Oh, I'm into it. Also, I have to watch Drop Dead Gorgeous, tonight.
I also have an idea for a drag act where I sing The Winner Takes It All, intercut with Audra McDonald's Tony speeches.
Oh, that would, like, kill it, P-Town.
I think it would. Anyway. JoJo shouts for a top. People mishear him, and they think he says yop.
And they all realize that there are people on the spec, on mm-hmm. the Clover, after all. And everyone comes together very quickly. Mm-hmm. Like, within 32 bars, the Sour Kangaroo is apologizing.
I mean, that's a staple in a lot of musical theater, though. Like, those kids in the prom went from homophobic to allies in a hot pivot turn.
Oh, yes. We all forgive Curly for literal murder over the course of a two-minute scene.
Oh, yeah. And more than that, we forgive him for mind-fucking Judd into contemplating suicide for a whole scene.
Correct.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We forgive a lot of musical theater if you can sing well.
If you can sing well and the writers have but 5 minutes before the end of the show.
Exactly.
Conclusions come pretty quickly.
Exactly. Especially when you add that framing device and you gotta close that shit up.
Yes.
And then the egg that Horton's on hatches and it's an elephant bird and he raises it with Gertrude, because even though they're different species, they love each other and they can give that elephant bird a good home.
Yes, the end. And then they sing maybe the best curtain call number ever, other than Cooties.
Cooties isn't the curtain call number for Hairspray, is it?
It's not. It's the end of the album, so I have never seen
Hairspray. No, you're
Hairspray
thinking about ba-da-ba-da-ba-ba-ba. Blood on the pavement,
yes.
What a mess.
Yes.
No, that's a cut song from Hairspray, and I hate that I know that. Cooties is Amber's talent song opposite Tracy.
Oh, okay.
Tracy Turnblad, this one's for you. I memorize a lot of basic bitch blonde tracks because I will never play them, and it's all I want to do.
Yes.
No one will let me do it.
Yeah. Well, as my knowledge of musical theater comes from cast albums, I just assume cut songs at the end are the finale or the curtain call number. It's a talent of mine.
Fucking funny.
But Green Eggs and Ham is the curtain call number of Seussical. It's great.
What is your ultimate favorite, most played song from that cast album?
Opening number.
Great.
Definitely. Biggest Blame Fool.
Mm-hmm.
I think Biggest Blame Fool was my like entry into the gospel musical theater. Into a, you know, at that time, Stephen Flaherty did the vocal arranging, mm-hmm. but that turned into my obsession with Stephen Remus's vocal arrangements, which sure. are all gospel inspired.
I mean, I think that opening number of Color Purple is just directly inspired by Biggest Blame Fool.
Yeah.
It's Sunday morning, Biggest Blame Fool. Chocolate.
I was known to, like, fuck with An Alone in the Universe when I was a child auditioning for community theater.
Sensible. At least you weren't doing Who Will Buy like that or Where Is Love. That kept you away from the rest of the crowds.
Oh, yeah. I was the only boy auditioning in Fosteria, Ohio for anything. So I booked all the leads. Don't worry.
But just like Little League, as soon as you got...
as soon as someone was better, I quit it right away.
Mm-hmm.
Those are top two. I mean, I actually think Seussical, in looking back, was something that led me in the direction of noticing like the music side, or the technical side of the music in musical theater.
Mm-hmm.
Those like really colorful Doug Besterman orchestrations, mm-hmm. which are actually really well preserved on the album.
They are.
I was like, oh, I can hear the reed players. I can hear those synth patches.
The balance is really good.
Yeah.
It's one of the last cast recordings I can think of also where the percussion sounds as rich as it probably was in the theater.
Mm-hmm.
One thing that bugs me, and I've been getting on my soapbox about this with cast albums lately, I'm a whore for percussion. I love a deep drum beat.
Yes.
And I find that cast recordings now favor shallower drum beats, I guess, because it's crisper, it's cleaner, it comes off better on a cast album now.
Mm-hmm.
But there are just some shows where, like, in the theater, the percussion is just so, I don't know, I keep coming back to deep, but you know, we're talking about yopping and whores, it just yes. it all falls into it.
There's a reverberance,
yeah.
And most of those cast albums were recorded acoustically in big rooms, you know, like yeah. the big Power Station room or like Demena, which is just like an enormous room where you get the echoes and the reverberance from kind of all of the instruments, that like ambient, ineffable thing that comes from a big room that most cast albums now, just for
money purposes. You know, people are tracked at different times in tiny studios. So your drummer is sequestered away in a soundproof booth where it, the sound doesn't have room to grow. So that's where that like shallowness is coming from.
How dare you bring science into this? I was just giving an opinion. No, but you know what I mean when I say that though, then, because it's not like a jazzy deep percussion with Seussical, but it's, but there is some reverberation to it.
Yeah.
And that is something that I adore and I wish we could get back a little bit. Cause it's just, I don't know. It's, like, I mean, you say, you know, all of Chorus Line back to back. There's a, the drumming in the third part of Hello 12, Hello 13, Hello Love, that bada bada. It's, you just listen to it and you're like,
Yes.
Okay. Like, you understand now why JoJo shouted yop. You're like, yop. That is, that I think should be every gay man's reaction to anything they find good in musical theater from now
on.
Yop, queen, yop.
Oh my god. Let's title that.
That's the title of the episode. Well, yeah. Well, I could do that.
Whatever.
It's, whatever, it's my fucking podcast.
The sea is so full of a number of fish. If a fellow is patient, he might get his wish. And that's why I think that I'm not such a fool when I sit here and fish in McElligan's pool. It's possible.
Let's go back to Seussical and try to wrap up that so we can make this a fulfilling episode for listeners and for yourself, so you can feel like you came here to actually do something.
An arc.
And not just talk about
Drop Dead Gorgeous.
Drop Dead Gorgeous and D-Hody.
Yes.
Although we could talk about D-Hody. So when you talk about your obsession with Seussical, like, I mean, you've proven to know quite a good deal about it. And I'm very impressed, because when people say, oh, I'm obsessed with this, it usually starts with the show itself, like, in terms of the plot and the people who are in it, and, like, end it there. But you know, like, some of the history, you know, the afterwards, all that good stuff.
Yes. I have... the things that I really loved for just heart reasons as a child, I have grown to love kind of intellectually now that I'm an adult and like in the industry. I'm kind of a not a scholar, that sounds so stupid, but
it is the word,
you know. I love investigating those things. I'm also a nerd, and then I just, when I go to see a show, I dive directly to the back tiny credits page to look at who the associate costume designer is, and if I can make a connection between that and like their Broadway debut as a designer. And
hey, the stories are great.
Yes.
Yeah.
Like on Seussical, I think Peter Helinski was on the sound team, who won the Tony this year. Maybe, but
for
designed,
sound
for sound, yeah. No, he did not design Hadestown, but was nominated twice for King Kong and Beetlejuice, maybe, but was a sound designer of Frozen and Something Rotten. And
I'm gonna take a face value on that, because I know the shows that were nominated, I don't know the names,
the designers, yeah.
I'm trying to get better at people, but there's just so much in the world,
there's so many designers, so many white men.
Yeah, I know.
As a white man.
As two white men, we're aware that there are too many of us.
Absolutely.
We're trying.
Yes.
I'm doing my part in trying to be less manly. So I can't do much about my whiteness.
Yes, we can shed our masculinity.
Yes, and I mean, I don't think my knowing every single word to Dreamgirls does much to tarnish my whiteness. In fact, that makes me probably more white. But... yeah, you know, I try to just be less manly as I can.
Yeah, we're working on it.
If Michelle Pak wants to top me, she can.
Yes.
if that will officially
to you.
Yeah, I think that'll officially make me no longer a man. Just letting Michelle Pak go to town on me. We both just contemplated it for a moment. Like,
we did. What would that be like?
I'm sure it'd be delightful.
I'm sure.
As long as she kept her Tony in the room and did her Maisie LaBert squawk at the end, I could finish. I could do it.
As long as you kept eyes on the Tony at all times.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's the only way I could have sex with some people in general.
Yes.
I need to look at your Tony. I don't need to touch it. Just need to look at it. And then you need to do, like, your famous whatever at the end.
Yes.
Anywho, what was your first production of Seussical that you did see live, though?
I saw essentially high school camp production at the Bellevue Society for the Arts in Bellevue, Ohio.
Like where the institution was?
No. That's in New York State.
Different Bellevue.
Yes, different. Bellevue, Ohio is...
I got very concerned for
that. Oh, a tiny, tiny town in northwest Ohio, but bigger than the town that I grew up in.
I thought it's also... Talk about a framing device for Seussical.
Yeah. Oh, my gosh.
Takes place at Bellevue.
Can you imagine? Yeah.
That's actually my framing device if I ever directed Cats, but I'm not... We're not talking about Cats. We're talking about Seussical.
Yes, we're talking about Seussical. That is a framing device that would have happened in a Northwestern production up there with the refugee camp into the woods.
Wait, was that actually a production?
Oh, that was a thing.
A refugee camp production of Into the Woods at Northwestern.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. As in the characters were... the pre-show was that you walked in and the characters were refugees prepping to put on a production of Into the Woods. And the giant was the guard in the tower. So when characters died in Into the Woods, they were shot from the tower. Oh, yeah. You're looking at me with such large eyes. I am not shitting you.
Alexis Bledel has nothing on my eyes right now. They are so wide.
They are so wide. And in fact, sometimes characters got shot by the guard before they died in the show.
What?
So the other characters had to pick up the slack and do the lines of the dead person. Like, the narrator died before the narrator dies in the show. So the other characters had to play the narrator whilst under duress, having watched the narrator been shot. It didn't make sense because then the guard shot some people at the time that they were supposed to die in the play when the characters knew they were going to die. Mm-hmm. It didn't make sense. It was a case of a director with it, Big Choices the musical.
Big Choices.
But I would be there for... The Bellevue Seussical.
As would I.
Jojo's alone in a with a straitjacket.
Yeah.
Imagines a hat from which comes a cat and the jungle of Newell.
Yeah, it's everything is a drawing on the wall, probably made of excrement that comes to life.
Oh my gosh. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yop.
Very theater of the poor.
Yop queen.
Yop queen.
So that was your first production, Bellevue.
That was my first production. And can I tell you, the only live production of Seussical I've ever seen. I've seen many a taped production of Seussical.
I mean, it was a staple at Stage Door Manor, let me tell you.
I believe starring two of my nearest and dearest, Betsy Hogan, Lucas McMahon.
Yeah, that's the production I saw.
Broadway's own on both counts.
On both counts, yeah. They both are Broadway people.
Yes.
Yes, Lucas was a wonderful Horton, and Betsy was a very funny cat in a hat. Cat in the hat, yes.
Yeah, Betsy Hogue replaced Celia Keenan-Bolger in Peter and the Starcatcher as Molly. Mm-hmm. Lucas McMahon, I believe former guest of this podcast...
Lucas is a former guest on the podcast.
Yes, big fancy Broadway producer.
Yes, big fancy Broadway producer. But yes, have you? I'm assuming you watched that video with Betsy and Lucas.
Lucas is too embarrassed. He will never ever show it to me.
What the? What? Then get Betsy to show it to you. That is criminal. That one of your biggest Broadway obsessions that two of your closest friends have been in, they won't let you see it.
I know. I should ask again. It lay dormant because it was a very fresh wound for Lucas for some reason, but...
It's been 14
it's
years.
Been yeah.
He can let it go.
Now it's time.
Yeah, he can shut the fuck up. And
that's my assignment.
Yes. Yes, before you go to Germany. It'll be your send-off present.
Yes.
If you were to music direct a revival of Seussical... Who's in your dream company?
Oh, my goodness.
I know you've thought about this.
I actually haven't.
Once again, you underwhelm me as a gay.
I know. Maybe a Kristen Milioti Gertrude moment.
Ooh.
Oh, yeah. Like we're talking like artisanal singing.
Well, and if it's a Bellevue Seussical.
Yes. Can we imagine that this is the Bellevue Seussical?
In my mind, it's just the production of Lazarus now, but like it's Seussical. Did you see Lazarus? Speaking of Kristen Milioti,
I did not.
It's crazy. Michael C. Hall stabbed Sophia and Caruso. She bled milk, and then they slip and slided through the milk to "We Can Be Heroes." Kristen Milioti wore a go-go wig and got strangled in a refrigerator. Yeah.
Wow. I would be into it.
Yeah, so that's this production of Seussical.
That's this production starring Rob McClure as the Cat in the Hat.
Yes! Oh, I love that.
Of course.
Of course.
He's an absolute genius.
Mm-hmm.
Who is my Maisie LaBird? Maybe a sensible Gray Henson as...
Gender fluid.
Oh, no. As Horton, I took a detour.
I was about to say, I would not be mad about Gray Henson playing Maisie LaBird. You know, he'd be a good Horton, yeah.
He would be a good Horton, but he'd be a better Maisie.
He would be. I would say, if we're trying to keep it in the original keys, I would have Leslie Kritzer record the vocals and then have Gray Henson lip sync to the vocals.
Yes.
I feel like that would be sensible.
Oh, a Kritzer Maisie would be iconic.
Oh, yeah. I mean, we'll just keep it in the Beetlejuice family now.
Yes, that's the Tony.
And then Carrie Butler and Sophia Ann Caruso will be two of the
Bird Girls.
Damn it, girl, this is your revival. You can cast whoever the fuck you want.
That's true. Oh, Alex Brightman as a Horton.
He'd be a good Horton.
He'd be a good Horton.
He would be a good Horton.
I think we need another take. We've seen the very sweet, simple version.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe the true... Bellevue patient take on it from Alex Brightman.
I'm sorry.
Like, too much coke Horton.
I wish that you people could hear my movements on this podcast, because when you said Bellevue Horton, I need everyone to know what Patrick just saw, which was me...
A convulsion?
It was a huge convulsion.
Yes.
I literally convulsed in my chair. It's brilliant. It's absolutely brilliant. And then I feel like there's one more we should have. That we haven't cast yet. We haven't casted JoJo. Maybe Sophia and Caruso, but I'd rather... I don't know. I want, like, one of those gay little kids from School of Rock that we don't know yet.
Luca Padovan. Do you know Luca?
Yeah.
The most talented person in the entire universe.
He played the gay kid in School of Rock, did he not?
He did.
Yes.
Yes.
And then he's Eliza and the little gay boy Skylar sisters.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not saying little gay boys in a derogatory Faye Dunaway kind of way. I'm saying it in a very endearing kind of way.
Yes, we're not punching anyone on this podcast.
No. We're not. We are serving tea, but not at 5.
Yes.
Oh, God. No. Anybody? Anybody? Faye Dunaway? I'm glad you got that joke, or at least you pretended to.
Oh, no. I did, because Faye Dunaway, just as a personality, intrigues me as someone so cruel.
Mm-hmm. Well, okay. So, Sue School and Faye Dunaway, I'll let you keep your gay card. Despite the fact that you don't watch Drop Dead Gorgeous or other movies.
So sorry.
That's all. No, yeah, that's fine. That's all fine. Luca, what's his face, is JoJo. And then we need some really sensible cameo for the bailiff. Just for that one bit.
Oh.
I need a good bailiff.
Who's my favorite?
Somebody throaty.
Yeah. I'm really thinking of, like, you know, prime vocals. Who would be, like, very special and just for me, or who would be perfect? Because, like...
It's your revival. What do you want?
I want...
D-Hody? You want some D-Hody in there?
But I do want, like, a Carolee Carmello.
Ooh!
To give me full Carolee for those 16 bars.
Carolee. She would find a way to have the vibrato of 90 million people in that one rise.
Yes.
Everyone rise.
Oh.
Rise. Every time I try to do her Do It Alone, Leo from Parade, it just comes out Irish.
Do it alone, Leo. Do it all by yourself.
After all, so many people love you. They're dancing in the streets, Leo.
Close.
I mean, kind of.
That's good impression.
That's how she says Leo. She goes, Leo.
Leo.
They're dancing in the streets, Leo. Anyway. I think this is a good place to come to an end.
I think
we've
so.
We've managed to talk about Sue School a surprising amount. You'd think that this is a rather off-topic obsession, but you listened to the one with Kevin Duda. We got off-topic a lot, so
yes.
It's fine.
There is no topic.
There was no topic. It was... And I'll say this out loud, because he and I have discussed this since then. He's like, yeah, I probably should have picked, like, a show. And I was like, yeah, you probably should have. Instead, he chose a frame of mind.
Yes,
and I was like, nobody thinks on Broadway.
Yes, what is thinking?
What is thinking?
People make decisions when they see dollar signs.
Absolutely. Every time Sutton Foster cooter slammed in Drowsy Chaperone, I didn't have a thought in my head.
It's just waves of adrenaline.
Yeah, I just was in those moments.
Yep.
So, we're going to come to the end of this. You can find Patrick Sulkin on all the social medias, I'm assuming, or just Instagram.
Just Instagram. I recently got rid of my Twitter because I thought it was toxic and awesome. It was not sparking joy anymore.
Good for you.
So you can find me on Instagram at Patrick Sulkin. Mm-hmm. I am on Facebook, but I won't friend you if I don't know you.
Yes, that is true. That it took us many years for you to finally accept my friend request.
No,
I was joking.
Oh, okay, great.
I'm sorry. You accepted immediately because okay, I'm me.
Yes, because I love you and I know you.
Yes,
there are people
now
that
you
have,
do.
There are people that have been in my Facebook purgatory for literal years, so I was afraid you there.
Fair.
You can reach out to me via Instagram, my website, patricksulkin.com. Really, those are the ways.
Those are the only ways? His phone number is...
Yeah, I was like, I could give you my phone number and email address, but I certainly won't.
No, we learned that the hard way.
Yes.
Patrick, we close out these episodes with a diva. I would like to extend the invitation to you of what diva you would like to have close us out today.
Any diva.
Well, hopefully one that we haven't done before, but you also don't know all the ones we've done before.
Oh, interesting. Should it stay in the world?
I mean, if you'd like... Unless you want to go really far out of left field.
Well, I can stay in the late 90s, early 2000s world and give you a Lilias White.
We did do Lilias White.
Oh, no.
Lucas asked for Lilias White.
Of course he did.
I know.
Did he ask The Life or How to Succeed?
So we don't usually choose the song. I choose the song. But I think when he requested it, I did do Brotherhood of Man. I believe that's what I picked. But don't quote me on that. You can find his episode. It's on iTunes.
Okay, great. I'll listen to it. I mean, like, star of my production of Seussical as the Bailiff, Carolee Carmello. Have we gone there?
I don't think so. Hold up. Una momento. Let's see. Have we done Carolee Carmello? We have not. We can do Carolee Carmello.
Perfection.
Perfection. I also love how you said star of your production of Seussical. She's a cameo.
Oh, yes. But
cameo Carmello.
Cameo Carmello. But she would be nominated for featured actress.
Oh, absolutely.
Yes.
It's a full-on King George III situation.
Absolutely.
5 minutes of stage time, but just bam.
Bam. I imagine her also playing Judge Yertle the Turtle. Like, she introduces herself and then steps up to the...
We're also going to keep it in the... mind frame of the original workshop production to Seussical and keep it small, so she'll also double as the mayor's wife because it's a cast of 10.
Yes.
So, yeah. So, it's a true tour de force. She's playing three characters in, like, one scene.
I actually think, were I to real-life revive Seussical, that's the vibe we want. We want a 10-person imaginative, like, theater of the poor, pull it out of a box.
Put it in the circle and the square, but somehow give me the same Broadway orchestrations. Somehow find a way for that Broadway pit to be in there.
Yes, yeah. A cast of 10, an orchestra of 16 or however many.
That's all I want.
I would die.
Give me
honestly,
a perfect world. Give me a black box production of Carousel with a 30-piece orchestra. Somehow make that shit work. Yes, queen. So we'll do Carolee Carmello then. Do you actually want to pick the song, or do you want to be surprised when you listen to this?
Well, I mean, you probably can't get Carolee singing "Winner Takes It All," can you? Because that's the
vibe. No, I can do it.
Okay, that's the vibe.
Yeah, I don't know if there's a professional recording of her doing it, but there's a very good video recording that I can get the audio of, if that's what you want.
You can do that, or you can surprise me. When I listen to this, I will be thrilled.
I'm not going to tell you what I'm going to do then.
Great.
Be surprised.
Perfect.
Next Monday.
I love that.
In the meantime, everybody, this is Broadway Breakdown. You can find me, Matt Koplik, on Instagram as well. And until then, keep breaking. I don't know. We don't usually have a real sign-off. It'll fade out and Carolee will start coming in.
Yeah, you have to have one.
Yeah. I don't. It's my podcast. I'll do whatever the fuck
I want.
Yop, queen. Yop. Yop.
Hey, it's Leslie Odom Jr. here on the Broadway Podcast Network to tell you about the RISE Theater Directory, a program of Maestro Music. RISE is a national online resource designed to connect and empower backstage and administrative and creative theater professionals from underrepresented backgrounds. If you work or aspire to work in the theater community, this can help you find your next project. And if you hire theater professionals, search the RISE Theater Directory to find your next team. Create your profile now and get more information by visiting risetheater.org. That's theater with an RISETHEATRE.org, because only together we rise.